Welcome to Amped Up. This is your host, Ryan Knight, and our guest today is Lisa Savage. Lisa is a teacher, an organizer, a progressive, and she is running for the United States Senate to replace Susan Collins. Lisa, welcome to Amped Up.
Thanks, Ryan. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. Since this is your first time on the podcast, why don't you give us a little bit about your background and why you're running for Senate?
Sure. Well, I've just retired from 25 years teaching school in Maine in the public schools in a pretty low income area. Prior to that, I had owned a small family business in central Maine for about 7 years, a successful business. And I was born in Maine, but I grew up in California. I went to high school in the Bay Area and then came back to Maine to go to Bowdoin College, left again for economic reasons. And then I've lived in Maine since 1988, built a house here, raised my kids here. And I'm running against Susan Collins, the least popular senator in the country right now, under ranked choice voting. And I have been organizing around the military budget and also climate and militarism for decades here in Maine. I was also a union negotiator for the teachers union for many years, but I have not run for other elected office. And honestly, if it were not for ranked choice voting, I doubt that I would be involved in this project.
Yeah, we're going to get to, I can't wait to talk about ranked choice voting because we need to bring that to all 50 states because I think it just gives the American people such better choices. But I want to start off and talk about what happened yesterday. You know, the president of the United States and his wife both tested positive for the coronavirus. And this comes just a day after Trump declared to the nation that, and I quote, "The end of the pandemic is in sight," which we know is not true. Coronavirus cases are on the rise again. We had a staggering 44,000 new cases yesterday alone. And now Trump is one of them. If anything, I hope this finally gets him to take the virus seriously and get the president's supporters to realize how serious and real this virus is so that they start wearing masks and we can stop the spread of the virus. What is your reaction, Lisa, to the president testing positive to the coronavirus?
Well, I have to say I'm not the least bit surprised because we see him on camera all the time doing unsafe things and exposing others to unsafe conditions. Here in Maine, we have had a nice low rate, but his son came campaigning for him, and there was a picture of all these people not masked, not socially distancing, all, you know, right there with each other. So it's, you know, I did not expect to see a microbe become so politicized. I was really shocked at the extent to which the current administration would use a virus that, you know, it has swept across the globe and it's unprecedented and we're learning how to keep ourselves safe from it and use it for political ends. The type of planning that came to light where they said, oh, well, all the states that have bad outbreaks have Democratic governors, so we won't help them.
Right.
Just the pitting of states against each other to compete in the open market for PPE. I've been calling for universal health care for decades. Now I think a lot of people in the United States understand why universal health care is not something we deserve or don't deserve or whatever. It's for the public health. Your health care is only as good as the person standing next to you in the grocery store line in a pandemic. So I'm not at all shocked that the president's family has, contracted the virus because they clearly weren't doing what they needed to do. It's been interesting to me, too. The mask wearing has been so controversial. And originally, we were told the mask wearing was to protect others, that unless you're wearing an N95 mask, it doesn't protect you. But the more recent research that I've been reading suggests that, yeah, actually, it does also protect the wearer somewhat, maybe not perfectly, but it does protect you from other people sneezing or coughing. And, you know, as we've learned more about interior spaces being the most risky, surfaces aren't really a big issue like we thought maybe. I just don't understand what is so hard for, Republicans to grasp about it's a germ. It's not political. You can do things to protect yourself and those you love, and politicizing it makes everyone more unsafe. I certainly think that the United States' reputation internationally has plummeted over our mishandling of the pandemic and the attempts to claim that, oh, China did this to us, or, you know, to nationalize a, a global pandemic, to me, that is just, you know, really bad thinking.
Yeah. And it also shows how partisan these times are, because when something, like you said, like a microbe, like a virus, you know, the virus doesn't care whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or an independent or a leftist, or, you know, it doesn't care about your political ideology. It affects all of us the same. And so I was very taken aback at how politicized that even something like a pandemic that now we've seen over 200,000 Americans die, see that. And I also, you know, the other unfortunate part for me is watching kind of not just Trump or the Republicans, also the Democrats, watching their initial reaction to this, you know, back in February and March. You know, the first thing they did is they bailed out their corporate donors, right? And gave a huge bailout package to the richest Americans, while, you know, working class and poor Americans got one $1,200 check, you know? And again, it speaks to this, you know, that yes, you know, Trump is bad, but we also have a government that, you know, when Trump is gone and after, when we vote him out, we're still going to be left with this government that is so beholden to powerful corporate interests. And it comes at the expense of the working class and the poor and millions of Americans who are struggling just to keep their head above water.
Yes, it does. When you have a bunch of millionaires or billionaires in Congress, or they were put there by very wealthy people, then they write laws that favor wealthy people. And, you know, I'm in the very odd position, lucky position. There are four people on the ballot in my race. It's a ranked choice voting race. I'm the only non-millionaire in the race. I'm the only non-multi-millionaire in the race. I'm married to a self-employed woodworker, fine woodworker. I've been a school teacher. I don't really believe that multimillionaires can understand what working people are struggling with and what their needs are.
I could not agree with you more. I think that we need more working class people in Congress. I absolutely. I want to ask you what you thought of the debate, because which feels like in these news cycles, it feels like that was 2 weeks ago. But, you know, we just had the presidential debate, and, you know, of course, you know, Trump kind of throwing a bone and emboldening white supremacists is like the national story. And that was egregious. But, you know, I also felt like, you know, Biden, the entire debate, he pretty much spent the whole debate attacking the left. You know, he's rejecting Medicare for all, rejecting a Green New Deal. And it felt to me like it was the debate that you get when you live in an oligarchy and neither party cares about, you know, the American people. I just was left with this overwhelming feeling that, like, the American people deserve better than this. You know, like, no one on that stage was fighting for the poor or fighting for the working class or communities of color or the planet. You know, what were your thoughts?
Well, what I've noticed is that the more the two corporate parties are sponsored by the very same corporations, you know, it's not like some corporations favor Republicans and some favor Democrats. They're the same corporate sponsors. The harder the two parties work to put on this, like, basically professional wrestling match to convince you that, oh, there's a deep, deep difference between these two. And the fact that, you know, Trump was calling out to the white supremacists and the militia, the white supremacist militias, saying, you know, stand by and intimidate people at the polls and be ready. That didn't surprise me at all. He's been doing it all summer. I suppose the fact that he did it on the national stage in the middle of the debate is the significant development. But yes, the majority of people want Medicare for all, yet the Democratic Party feels that it doesn't even need to pay lip service to what people are struggling with. You know, all the other wealthy countries have Medicare for all, universal health care. Many non-wealthy countries have universal health care, and most of them got it after World War II. We're still waiting. And most financial ruin for working people in the U.S. stems from some kind of illness. Someone in the family has an illness or an accident. They may very well have this, you know, Unaffordable Care Act for profit health insurance. They can't afford to use it, or they use it and then they end up losing their house over it. I don't think, you know, the Democrat I'm running against in this race says the same thing. Well, I want to make the Affordable Care Act more affordable. The people that I've been working with in the families, in the public schools where I teach for years, it doesn't matter how quote, affordable you make it, they aren't going to be able to afford to use it. The premiums are too high, the copays are too high, the deductibles are too high. And the Democratic Party clearly doesn't feel that it needs to even take that into account. They're like, you know, take it or leave it. The Republicans are really bad. Do you want them? No, then you have no choice. Well, in Maine, we have a choice, but nationally, I think we really, really need ranked choice voting at the national level.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is one of the things that could help us kind of break up this duopoly to give the American people more choices. You know, I kept thinking when I was watching the debate, like, there actually are more candidates running for president. You know, we have Howie Hawkins is the Green candidate, and there's a Libertarian candidate, and there's an independent candidate, Mark Charles, who's a Native American. And, you know, we have a socialist candidate for the Socialist and Liberation Party. And I just thought to myself, like, you know, the American people would have benefited instead of hearing these two rambling back and forth and screaming at each other back and forth. The American people, it would have been nice to see like four more voices up on that stage, you know, just to see actual like real choices. But of course, you know, because of, you know, the way the corporate media and the way the corporations, you know, have bought off our government, you know, the oligarchy kind of maintains its power by pretending like these are our only options, right? You only get the liberal or the conservative. You know, they don't even give you, they don't even bring up the other choices that that we could have. And the other point that you know, look, I don't support Donald Trump. I definitely won't be voting for him. But I voted for Hillary in 2016. But as a progressive, you know, I am so tired of the Democratic Party taking our votes for granted and taking working class people for granted. And so I haven't endorsed Joe Biden. And I'm actually probably, you know, I live in California. I've said that I'm not going to vote for him. I'm going to vote green this cycle and then vote for down ballot progressives. Because, you know, also in the debate, it's like, for me, it exposed the DNC's failed election strategy of taking more progressive and independent voters for granted to chase these mythical moderate Republicans, because Trump really solidified his base. Because of course, I disagree with him, you know, emboldening white supremacists. But what a lot of liberals don't realize is his supporters secretly like that. So Trump is literally energizing his base while Biden is saying he doesn't support, you know, Medicare for All or a Green New Deal. So Biden is like deflating his base. So it's like one corporate party gives its voters everything it wants. And then the other corporate party is literally like running away from the progressive policies that its voters want that will get them out to vote. And then if they lose, like they did in 2016, they blame the very voters that they took for granted when they lost. Like, it's insanity to me.
It's almost like the two parties take money from the same corporations.
Right.
You know, it seems to me in my experience that the corporations, there are corporate overlords, I often refer to them as, would prefer to have two-term presidents, because it probably is very time-consuming to find all the skeletons in the closet and pay them off and make sure everybody's hushed up. And, you know, they don't want to do that every 4 years. They want to do that every 8 years. So the show of, oh, these two candidates, they're so different. Of course, they pick certain issues such as, oh, we're going to take away your reproductive rights, women. Now, what do you say? You know, it's scare tactics and using fear to motivate people. I mean, I've been a school teacher. The only thing that actually works to motivate people, according to all research I've ever read, is supporting their autonomy. Actually, in the very short term, you can motivate someone with a carrot or a stick, but long term, you have to support their free will and the, you know, their ability to make decisions for themselves and live with the consequences or learn from the consequences. But all this fear mongering, it's ramped up so much in my lifetime, Ryan, that I'm starting to wonder, like, how much higher could it go at this point?
Yeah, and fear is not a policy or a solution that is going to move our nation forward, right? You know, fear and the fear of Trump, even if you think Trump is super scary, you know, that's not Trump is bad is not a policy that's going to solve or stop the climate crisis. You know, saying Trump is bad isn't going to stop the, you know, cost of healthcare crisis and the pandemic, you know, saying Trump is bad isn't going to stop the racial injustice crisis or the economic inequality crisis. Like, you need bold, progressive policies that will actually improve the lives of the American people. But we're stuck in this kind of, like, you know, vicious cycle that seems to just, it's been going on for decades, where you either vote for, you know, it's like you either vote for evil or the lesser of two evils. It's not the kind of politics that will ever really benefit, you know, the American people. And I just think now we're in a state where there is, like, a convergence of crises. You know, like I said, from the climate crisis to the healthcare crisis to the, you know, racial injustice crisis, that it's like, for years, Washington's been kicking the can down the road. And now it's like, we are at a point where, like, we can't wait any longer. Like, the American people need meaningful change right now. But yet, every election in the past 50 years has been, right, the quote unquote most important election in history. Yet after each one of the elections, no matter who won, the wars continued, the inequality continued, the injustice continued, and the destruction of our planet continued. And the reason I found out in the last year is because the problem is not Republicans or Democrats. The problem is Republicans and Democrats. The problem is the corrupt duopoly that we live in.
It's so true. Most people that I speak to are scared of climate crisis more than anything. Of course, Black people are scared that someone will bust through the door while they're sleeping and shoot them dead and just walk away without any consequences. But every thinking person on the planet is scared about climate emergency. The West Coast was on fire all summer. There's still huge fires in the wine country out in California, huge fires in Australia. You know, we just go back and forth in the Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere, having these out of control fires, and the ice is melting. The extinction of animals and plants should be very alarming, and certainly scientists are alarmed. And I feel like young people look at my generation and go, what part of emergency do you not understand about the phrase climate emergency? There is no time to dither-dather around and engage in play acting on the debate stage. We should be implementing a very vigorous Green New Deal, bold action, immediate emergency bold action to mitigate the effects of climate crisis. And, you know, I'm glad you brought up the wars. One of the things I've been organizing around for years is very few people realize how much money the Pentagon gets each year. Very few people, because they hide it, they trick you. Even what they show on paper is far below. It's really the cost of militarism, if you include the VA, which I'm all for funding the VA, but if you add that into the cost and the secret CIA stuff and the nuclear bombs that are in the Energy Department, and then add that to the Pentagon's corporate welfare scheme, we're spending about 70% of the discretionary budget of the U.S. year after year on military, whether there's a D or an R after the name of the person in the White House. It's also really bad for climate. It's driving climate crisis. The Pentagon is the biggest institutional consumer of fossil fuels on the planet. Its greenhouse gas emissions are greater than that of 140 nations, if you listed it, you know, with nations. And that is hidden from the public. Nobody talks about it. And, you know, supposedly the wars are making us safer. A Green New Deal that stopped building weapon systems would be one win for climate. Then use that same federal funding and build something to mitigate climate change. The public transportation system we lack in Maine would be a wonderful start to get us out of our cars, or, you know, clean energy systems, offshore wind, regenerative agriculture, so that our farmlands are supported and our food security is secure for the future. And really, we should have, I think, consumer-owned utilities. The internet, water, and electricity should all be consumer-owned and operated utilities. That's my vision of a Green New Deal. I mean, I'll admit that I got it from the Green Party. I was a Green Party member. I had to unenroll to make ballot access here in Maine, but I will enroll back in the Green Party as soon as I win the election. And their Green New Deal is awesome. And it's got budgets, it's got details. And the, you know, Democrats took the phrase Green New Deal, watered it down. And, you know, that's the kind of bold action that we need to kind of pull us back from the brink of not only human extinction, but a lot of other life forms would probably go down with us.
Yeah, you're hitting the nail on the head. It is unconscionable to me that our government spends trillions of dollars. I mean, I think our annual military budget this past year was $750 billion. But you're absolutely right. When you add in the other things, it's over $1 trillion we're spending basically on war, on blowing up the planet. So, you know, it's like, when are the American people going to wake up and see like we are an empire? When you're spending over a trillion dollars on war a year, like, we are the empire. When you watch the movie, you know, you're watching the movie and there's like the resistance, there's the good guys, and there's the bad guys that are like taking over. Like, we're the bad guys. And also the cost of war, you know, since 2001, the quote unquote war on terror, we have killed, there's over 1 million people have died throughout the world because of the war on terror. And even worse, 34 million people have been displaced. The United States has created 34 million refugees that have been displaced by this war, this endless war we've been fighting since 2001. So it's like we are destroying the world. And I think to myself, why not instead of destroying the planet and bombing the planet, don't we spend money to actually save the planet, you know, from the climate crisis and save humanity? Because you are absolutely right that we are on the brink. Eventually, we are heading toward extinction eventually. And I think a lot of people don't realize that. And so we've got to shift our consciousness and wake up and have this revolution of like, we don't want to be a government that spends trillions of dollars to blow up the world. We want to spend that money to heal the world and save the planet.
Yes. Well, I think the underlying problem is information control. And, you know, my hat is off to you, Ryan, for doing the work of bringing truth to the most heavily propagandized people who have ever existed. Most, you know, people think propaganda tells you made up facts or wrong information. But the real power of propaganda is in directing your gaze and saying, only this is worthy of your attention. Nothing else outside of this little peephole that we've given you is worthy, you know, is worth you knowing about. We have the internet. It's become increasingly censored, of course. But with access to information and the will to find it, you know, you can do research. You can, you know, get outside your information box and say, corporate media, they're not bringing me the truth. They don't want me to know the truth. Why don't I look for some independent journalists? Why don't I look for some cultures that do value the truth a little bit more in journalism? But I mean, look at Julian Assange. He's probably the most significant bringer of truth to the American people, the people worldwide of his generation. And he's been allowed to be essentially tortured to death in prison for being a journalist.
Right.
For being a journalist.
And because I'm so glad you brought up Julian Assange, because he is the one who revealed that he released documents that revealed that the United States committed war crimes, essentially. And so we have to be clear about this. That is the only reason the United States government is going after him. They are going after him because they are basically saying, we are above reproach, that we want to be able to continue to engage in these endless for-profit wars that make the oligarchy and make, you know, all these rich people a lot of money. Because let's be clear, these wars, we are sending working class people over to fight wars to make rich people richer. You know, the defense industry is one of the most profitable industries in this country. And so we're fighting these wars to make rich people richer. And that's why they're going after Assange, because they don't want there to be, you know, freedom. They don't want accountability. They don't want, some other journalist to do what Assange did. So they're trying to say, look, if you try to reveal any documents that show what we're really up to, we're going to go after you. And we're going to use all of our power to come to silence you. And I just think it goes against, you know, here we're supposed to believe in freedom of the press, right? It's embedded in our Constitution. And yet we're going after a journalist for revealing the truth. It, you know, we're so far from democracy. You know, we're so far from these values that you hear these politicians espouse on TV. You know, we really are an authoritarian, you know, fascist, oligarchic nation.
Indeed. You know, 9/11 was a big event, obviously, of my life. And I taught high school for many years after that. And I began to realize, like, oh, kids don't even know about 9/11. They don't know what that is. It means nothing to them. It means, like, if I said the sinking of the Lusitania, they'd have the same reaction, like, huh? And so, of course, the, propaganda machine has to gin up all this patriotic fervor around, the events. And if you look at all the things that were put in place as the result of the unfortunate events of 9/11, you know, trashed the Constitution and civil liberties, endless wars for profit that, as you pointed out, have caused suffering for, you know, tens of millions of people. And, you know, assault on the truth, assault on journalism and the First Amendment. But again, with a lack of information, young people, they don't really know about 9/11 or anything like that, but they know, ooh, you better act patriotic or it could, you know, things could go badly for you. It's required that you be patriotic. And I was a history major and I would argue that, well, I am being patriotic. I'm looking at my country and saying, we're headed right off the cliff and somebody's got to speak up. I may not be able to stop it, but I'm not going to be able to live with myself if I don't speak up and say, hey, we're headed off the cliff over here. Does that make me unpatriotic? You know, many people, I go on right-wing talk radio shows here in Maine and they call me a moon bat and all sorts of things, but people do not have access to good information. They just don't. And they don't even know that they don't.
Well, that's right. And we also, I mean, a big problem too is just the deceitfulness of the American politicians who, you know, they use civility and decorum to dress up our corrupt system that perpetuates these endless wars and economic inequality and racial injustice and climate catastrophe. You know, they sedate the public with platitudes of hope and change, while they're governing for their corporate donors, one of which is the defense industry, or big pharma or the giant insurance companies. You know, that is why these Democrats don't support Medicare for All or why they don't support a Green New Deal, because it's bad for their corporate donors. It might be good for the people, but it's not good for their donors. And so, you know, they just sedate us with platitudes and instead of fighting for the real systemic change that we need to actually heal this nation and move this nation forward.
It's so true. Other social democracies recognize that, you know, not every human activity is appropriate as a profit center. So, right. Commodifying healthcare, bad idea. The word, yes, profit and healthcare don't even belong in the same sentence together. Commodifying access to clean water, these are bad ideas. Commodifying access to education. I was a history major, so I always wonder, like, okay, I'm pretty sure Donald Trump never studied history, but, you know, there are a lot of college educated people in the government. Did they never study what happens next after you have allowed income inequality and poverty to deepen, where people are born into generational poverty that they have absolutely no prospect of ever getting out of? And, you know, and then people of color are going, like, no matter how affluent and educated I am, they can still just gun me down in the street and there's no consequences. When you get to a point in society like that, you know, what generally happens is a revolution, because the poor have nothing left to lose. And they're like, well, my life isn't going to get any better. I guess I better try to overturn the system and see if at least there might be a better life for my children or my grandchildren, maybe. It seems to me that these, you know, when Nancy Pelosi, okay, so I'm not on media all the time, but do you remember at the beginning of the pandemic when Nancy Pelosi took people into her kitchen and showed them her two super fancy, like tens of thousands of dollars refrigerators that were filled with fancy gelato flavors? So I saw that online as a video clip, and I thought it was like an old maybe edition of some show like Cribs, where rich people take, because I couldn't believe that she would do something so Marie Antoinette in the pandemic. And then people were like, oh no, Lisa, that was during the pandemic. She was showing, okay, we're locked up here at home. Here's what, it's unbelievable to me that they do not get that this is unsafe for everyone. I guess they're just in a bubble where they think nothing can touch me. Like, what planet do they think they're going to live on? Is Elon Musk going to whisk them all away to some artificial planet B? What is their long game here? I just don't get it.
Yeah, well, and I think, again, this they've been able to maintain this corrupt power, both parties, because they've used these wedge issues to divide us. You know, that is how the oligarchy stays in power. They divide and conquer, you know, and most Americans are so blinded by political partisanship that they cannot see that both corporate parties are rigging the system against us.
Sure. You know, and so, racism has been used to absolutely. Racial fear and distrust has been used to divide the working class since the very beginning of this, the settler, you know, colonial settler society that we brought here and started the genocide of the native people, but always been pitting the, you know, create this racial hierarchy and make sure that no matter how downtrodden a white person is, they can always feel superior to somebody on the basis of like melanin in their skin. It's a crazy scheme.
No, it's one of the big issues they use. And that's why, you know, the biggest fear of the oligarchs and of this corrupt system is a multiracial working class coalition coming together, because that is how we take back power in America. And Bernie Sanders almost did it twice, you know, but they, you know, again, he was fighting against the giants. I mean, you to free this nation, you have to go up against, you know, the corporate media. You have to go up against the giant corporations. You have to go up against Wall Street. You have to go up against the billionaire class. And you have to go up against two corrupt corporate parties. That is a lot to take on, you know, and that is what, you know, essentially Bernie tried to do, you know, in 2016 and again in 2020. But I'm glad you brought up this idea of these politicians being so out of touch that they don't realize that revolution is right on the doorstep, because you're absolutely right. There was numbers recently that the current levels of inequality in America are higher than the levels of inequality in France just before the French Revolution.
I couldn't believe that. Billionaires became trillionaires in the pandemic, right?
Almost. I mean, we are at a space where Jeff Bezos in a few years will set to become the first trillionaire. We are at a point now where it's just two men, Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates, now own more wealth than half of our entire nation. Just think about that. Two people hold more wealth than half of our entire population. And so it is unsustainable. I mean, we are headed in one direction. And I just think that, you know, these bubbles that these politicians have built and the ruling class has built, that they're going to pop, because something has to give. This is not, you know, you cannot expect people to live in these conditions, especially, you know, look, people say we're the richest nation on the world, yet we have 92 million people who they're underinsured or uninsured. And we have 140 million Americans right now who are either poor or low income. You know, it's like, this is not, you know, there is nothing good about our system. And if we don't have massive systemic change soon, I think that we are heading for a revolution. And I think that it would be necessary to free this nation from, you know, corporate rule and from the oligarchs that have a stranglehold over our government right now.
Sure. Let's hope it's a revolution and not a civil war, huh? That's what the oligarchy is gunning for. I know that childhood hunger has increased dramatically since the pandemic began. And, you know, that's where my heart lies. I have children of my own. They're grown up. I have grandchildren, but I've been a teacher for many years because I really love kids and I like spending my day with them. You know, when your child is going to bed hungry, you know, that has a sort of an effect on people. Now, many people, of course, succumb to one of the diseases of despair. They're, you know, succumb to depression or substance use disorder. Many kill themselves because their life is just unsustainable. But when you are letting little children go to bed crying from hunger while someone becomes the first trillionaire, you need to break down that system and start over, because that there is nothing good about that system. I completely agree with you, Ryan.
Well, and this level of poverty in our country is a policy choice. And we need a government that will start investing in the American people with policies like Medicare for all and housing for all and college for all and living wages for all and a basic income for all. If you are elected to the Senate, will you fight for policies that lift up the people? And will you stand up to the other senators who will want to continue to govern for their corporate donors?
Of course I will. That's the only reason that I am trying to get into the U.S. Senate. Maine has Maine has some interesting things about it. For one thing, I love Maine. I was born here. My family's from here. I'm very happy here. I really don't want to move to Washington, D.C. at all, but I will. And Maine has only barely about 1 million voters. So there, it's not like trying to run for the Senate in New York or California or something. You could reasonably expect a lot of voters to know who you were, you know, and know what you stood for. And one of the things that inspires me, honestly, is the example of Margaret Chase Smith. She was a senator who went to high school with my grandfather, and they remained friends for life because they both went into politics. My grandfather ran an ice company, cutting ice out of the river and selling it before there was refrigeration. But he served in the Maine legislature for many years. And they, you know, continued to be friends. My grandfather died early of his war injuries from World War I. But Senator Smith lived on, and I have met her, and we lived across the river from each other for many years. She went to the Congress as appointed to fill a vacancy caused by her husband's death. But then she ran for election, and eventually she was the first woman who was elected to both the House and then subsequently elected to the Senate. And as a freshman senator, Joe McCarthy was terrorizing everyone in the Senate, you know, threatening them with, I'm going to expose you as a communist, you're going to lose your career. And many, many people did lose their career and lose their livelihood. But she really didn't like it. And she vaulted to fame with this speech that's called the Declaration of Conscience, where as a freshman senator, she was a diminutive lady, now about 5 feet tall. She stood up and said, I'm from Maine. We don't like bullies there. And you can't bully me. Go ahead. Call me un-American. Call me a communist. I don't care. You know, it seems to me the people that are screaming the loudest about Americanism right now are the ones that have forgotten that some of the basic precepts of Americanism are the right to hold an unpopular opinion. And this speech galvanized her colleagues in the Senate. None of them would like stand with her beforehand, but afterwards, many of them rushed over and said, you know, sign me up. And it kind of, you know, it made her a minor celebrity. I've taught that speech many times. I am inspired by that example. I'm not interested in wealth. If I was interested in wealth, would I have spent the best earning years of my life being a rural school teacher in Maine? I have no experience accepting donations from corporate lobbyists and then writing legislation to benefit those corporations. I have no experience doing that because that's not what I'm going to do. I am willing to speak the truth and speak up. I've been doing it for years in other, you know, ways than running for office, but I am willing to take this on to be a voice of truth for people. And we're getting a pretty good reception here in Maine. Susan Collins is very unpopular and has enabled Trump right and left. The Democrat that they nominated is a super centrist corporate Democrat, doesn't want Medicare for all, doesn't want a Green New Deal. You know, there's another independent in the race who's to the right of Susan Collins, who fancies himself a Trump or a Paul LePage, who was our old governor, very clownish and, you know, transgressive all the time to get media attention. And then there's me just saying my version of the truth. And we've had two debates now, and the outpouring of support for our campaign after those debates, where people go, wow, you know, you were the only one there answering the questions. You're the only one there who seems to want to, you know, look out for people's interests, and that is listening to people in Maine saying, wow, you know, we're struggling here. Help us out. So I think I actually, under ranked choice voting, have a shot at winning this election.
I love that. And I love that story you told, because that is the kind of courage that we need to start seeing from our elected officials in Washington, who go there and to apparently they're supposed to represent the people, but they forget that right after they get elected, and they just go in there to make, you know, the ruling class richer and to you know, help their corporate donors. So, you know, that kind of courage, that moral courage to fight, you know, for the downtrodden and to fight for the working class is what's missing in Washington. And that's why I was excited to have you on my podcast, and why I'm excited to have anyone who's brave enough and bold enough to stand up to corporate power. Because I really do believe that is what is stopping. You know, I've never looked in, Donald Trump has always just been a symptom to me, you know, and the disease is the greed, you know, the corporate greed that has a stranglehold on our government. And, you know, when you look at the Democratic Party, you know, they're so good at kind of co-opting the language of the progressive movement. You know, they'll say healthcare is a human right, but they won't actually support the policy, Medicare for All, to make healthcare a human right. You know, they'll say climate change is real, but they won't support a Green New Deal to actually do something about climate change. They'll say that Black Lives Matter, but they won't support, you know, defunding police and shifting resources into Black and brown communities. So instead of having a police officer show up if someone's drunk, we have a wellness officer, you know, or a social worker show up. You know, there's none of that going on right now in the Democratic Party, because they're just, you know, vote for us because, you know, we're not as bad as Trump, you know, and that's not a vision. That's not, you know, don't tell me what you're fighting against. Tell me what you're fighting for. You know, what are you for? And that was, I felt like, why Hillary lost in 2016. Her entire campaign was anti-Trump. You know, was Trump bad, Trump bad, Trump bad. And, you know, there were people who were struggling and suffering, who wanted more than just, you know, the other guy's bad. You know, tell me what you're going to do for me. And someone like Trump comes along, and I didn't vote for him, but, you know, he basically was like a con man, and he made all these false promises. And the point is when you allow people to get desperate enough, because you have policies that don't help them, they'll get desperate enough to go vote for a con man. And they did. And so, you know, we have to shift the consciousness in our nation away from corporate greed and toward human need. You know, we've got to shift away from corporate welfare and move to human welfare. You know, if not, I really do worry about what is going to happen next. You know, I just don't think it's sustainable, the direction we're heading. And I, you know, I want to ask you about ranked choice voting, because, you know, I think that's a big piece of this. I think that, you know, if we can get ranked choice voting, not just in Maine, but if we can bring that to all 50 states, you know, people won't have to vote for their fears. You know, they can vote for their hopes. They can vote for progress. They can vote for a better world. Do you want to kind of just outline, like, what ranked choice voting is and why it's so important to kind of break up this stranglehold that the two parties have over our electoral system?
Sure. Well, ranked choice voting is something that Mainers organized and fought hard to get. We have the referendum here, so we can, people, you know, can vote to say what they want, but that doesn't create laws. So the referendum got passed by a majority, and then the Democrats and Republicans dragged their feet in the legislature to turn it into law. So they passed a referendum again. At that point, you know, they enacted part of it. Right now, we have it for statewide elections. We have it for president. And the GOP has taken it to court many times, but they keep losing. The Maine Supreme Court has twice ruled in this campaign season, yeah, you're having ranked choice voting for president. Like, live with it. So the way it works in Maine, it's sometimes easier to understand if you think of it as instant runoff voting, and it's sometimes called that. So there are four people in this race. There's Susan Collins, there's the Democrat, there's me, and there's the other independent. You get a ballot that looks kind of like a standardized test, where you're going to bubble in by my name. You're going to rank me first, okay, because I want Medicare for All and a Green New Deal. Then you're going to say, who's the safety choice here in case Lisa doesn't win? Who am I going to bubble in? We're telling people, vote blue, number two. Go ahead and bubble the Democrat in second, because you definitely don't want the incumbent anymore. And
wait, time out. Did you just say vote blue number two?
In ranked choice
voting. That's amazing. No, I love that. That's amazing. Because I'm so tired of people saying vote blue no matter who.
Right,
that whole
right.
What happened in the whole primary. Sorry to interrupt you, but it just,
no, exactly.
That's brilliant, because it's like, no, it matters who you vote for, people. Policy matters.
Yeah, we have a great comms team.
That's
I can't
amazing.
Take credit
vote
for that
blue
phrase.
Number
but
two. That's genius.
So then when the election is held, they count the first ranking votes first, okay? If anybody has a majority, meaning 50% plus one vote, then game over, you have won the election. That candidate is done, you have no runoff rounds. But if in this case, in this election, it's very, very likely no one will reach 50%, they then go, okay, who got the fewest votes? They cross that candidate off and they say, people that picked that candidate first, who did they pick second? And they transfer those votes to the other candidates. Now, does anybody have a majority? Still no? Repeat the process one more time. And so it basically was a way. We had had a very bad governor, a Tea Party governor for a couple of years that was elected by plurality and maybe like only 36% of Mainers wanted him. And he was a disaster policy-wise. So I think that was a lot of the impetus behind getting ranked choice voting in. And so it does allow for positive issues-based campaigning. It really suggests that you shouldn't attack other candidates and conduct a really negative campaign against them, because you don't want to alienate supporters of other candidates, because you would hope to get their number two or number three ranking. The odd thing about this election is, or maybe it's not that odd, predictable, is that the Democrat and the Republican have completely refused to ever say the words ranked choice voting. They are running the most negative campaign, the most negative Senate campaign that has ever been waged in the U.S. They have spent tens of millions of dollars, mostly raised outside Maine, to attack each other. They lie about each other constantly, name calling, spitefulness, even in the debates. And that's not a good strategy under ranked choice voting. Places like Australia that have had it for, you know, years, a lot of candidates will preference swap. They'll get together and say, hey, if you tell your supporters to rank me second, I'll tell my supporters to rank you second. You know, candidates that have policies that are similar. Nobody that's in this election really seems to have grasped that at this point. We've already had it unseat. I don't know if you remember Bruce Poliquin. He was the second district. Maine only has two congressional districts. Second district is the poor one that I live in up north. And we had Bruce Poliquin, who was this Wall Street darling, very unpopular incumbent, constantly running away from people. He was famous for ducking into a ladies' room to avoid journalists that were trying to question him. So not a popular guy, but when the election, the Democrat challenging him was a fairly young veteran. He ran on his reputation as having gone to Iraq and Afghanistan. He was in the Maine legislature. A few people knew him, but not super big name recognition. Well, when the first count was finished, the incumbent had won, but he didn't have a majority. There were two independents in that race. And when those second, you know, the second choice votes of people that picked them first were transferred, Jared Golden took the seat. So the Democrat, and we ousted a very unpopular conservative using ranked choice voting to elect a moderate Democrat. Now, I'm not hoping that's what happens in my race, because I would like to go to the Senate and represent the people of Maine. But why the Democrats are so scared of it? Like, don't they? They've seen it work. Why is it that we keep ignoring? And then the polls. So most of the polls have completely ignored this. Most polls call people and go, so if the election was tomorrow, would you vote for the Republican or the Democrat? They don't even mention that there are these other. And so, you know, we'll turn up in that poll as 9% undecided, which is their euphemism for, we refuse to ask you about the independent that's on the ballot. We're only giving you the two choices. We had a great letter to the editor today in the Bangor Daily News from one of our campaign supporters who said, this is like taking your kids to the ice cream store with 15 flavors and saying, but you can only have chocolate or vanilla.
Yeah. Well, that's how they control us. They keep us locked in these two parties, and these two parties have a few wedge issues that divide us, but their consensus is that both of the corporate parties, right? They believe in predatory capitalism. They believe in for-profit healthcare. They believe in, you know, putting their corporate donors over the basic needs of the people. They believe in endless wars. They both don't support a New Deal. I mean, there's so much consensus between the parties. And what you just said a minute ago, when you said that these two, you know, the Democrat and Republican in Maine are running the most negative campaign ever, what flashed in my mind is, like, I want the American people to start seeing is that, like, our lives don't get better when Democrats and Republicans are just throwing food at each other. You know what I mean? Like our lives get better when politicians fight for policies that will improve that will help our lives. But again, our country, it's turned into this like back and forth between these two very powerful parties that don't really care about us. And so ranked choice voting can kind of break that up. I mean, that is so refreshing to hear that, like, you know, you can get that negative campaigning can hurt you because you actually have to campaign to everyone, because who someone places second on the ballot, that matters. You know, that will start giving some accountability to these politicians who just want to kind of use the same few messages to attack each other. That's not really constructive for our people or for the planet or for any kind of change.
I think false dichotomy is a very powerful error of thinking that has been used against us. If you think about it, the minute you're born, you're assigned to a binary gender, like you're one or you're the other. Well, we found out that wasn't really true, didn't we? And then all through life, well, okay, which team are you rooting for? You know, is it this team or the professional sports continue to reinforce that false dichotomy idea? I think it's a way, again, it's a propaganda method of keeping you from seeing there's so much reality outside of this binary choice that I've been, you know, limited to.
Yeah. And I think that how is America ever going to get better if our two choices are evil or a little bit less evil? Like we're not. Like, that's where I'm just like, you know, we have to break out of this. We have to break the duopoly. We have to break this vicious cycle. I feel like, you know, we're stuck in this cycle where we go back and forth between a right-wing fascist and a neoliberal corporate extremist. And neither of those options are going to heal our country or do anything for the working class of this country.
It's really true. I mean, when you've held your nose and voted enough times that you have a nosebleed and you go, okay, I'm done with that. I don't want to do it anymore. You can either vote independent or vote third party, which I've certainly done in the past. And then what most people do, they just don't vote at all. So then, you know, everyone wants to blame someone like Jill Stein for running for president, like the audacity to participate in our democratic process. Who does she think she is? And, you know, so then when Hillary loses, they want to blame it on Jill Stein. Libertarians polled higher than Jill Stein did, but the biggest group of voters that didn't elect Hillary were people that are so disgusted by this process that they just don't vote.
Well, and it's not, Hillary Clinton lost the election because of Hillary Clinton. It is her job as a candidate to go out and earn people's votes. This idea that voters, you know, lose candidates' elections is propaganda and gaslighting. Candidates who take voters for granted lose elections. You know, these votes are not owed to these corporate Democrats. You know, they have to go out and earn our votes. And so, you know, I've been met with a ton of pushback because I, as a prominent, you know, activist and a leading progressive voice, like, I'm not supporting Joe Biden. And I haven't really discussed this, but I probably should, because it's just so egregious what they did. They're like literally releasing opposition research on me as if I'm a candidate running for office. And one of the accounts that's a DNC, they're linked to the DNC. They've worked for the DNC in the past and they're tied to Kamala's campaign. They dug up my DUIs from 20 years ago, from before I got, I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I've been sober for 9 years. They literally, thank you. They literally posted the DUIs I got when I was 18 and 19 on the internet last week to try to silence and shame me. Like, this is the length that the DNC is going to, instead of actually like supporting the policies that the people want. 88% of Democratic voters want Medicare for all. 85% of Democratic voters want a Green New Deal. Instead of supporting these popular policies to galvanize voters to the polls, they're attacking progressive activists and trying to cancel and shame and silence progressive activists who are strong and brave enough to show some dissent and say that, like, yeah, you know, it's not my job to earn Joe Biden votes. If you want to be if you want to be president, you know, support a Green New Deal, support Medicare for all. Your job is to get behind the people. It's not the people's job to get behind you. You have to earn the people's vote and earn the people's trust. And we're so far from that. I mean, and look how the Democratic Party tried to you know, get the Greens kicked off the ballots. Like, that's not democracy.
They didn't just try. They got the Greens. They got the Greens kicked off the ballot in a couple states.
It feels to me like the Democratic Party is becoming, it's like they're becoming Trump and becoming authoritarian, more authoritarian to beat Trump. And it's just so sad to me because it's such a missed opportunity. Like, this was a moment for the party to finally, like, to fight for justice and to fight for these policies, not just to beat him, but that we need to move our nation forward, that we need to stop the climate crisis, and that we need to help our people who are just struggling so much. But no, they'd rather release DUIs that I got 20 years ago and silence progressives than actually, like, do anything for the people. It's so upsetting to me.
Well, it's a very dirty pool, of course, to try to use shame against someone who is in recovery. I know the recovery community here in Maine would say, you know, we recover out loud so that others don't die silently. And it sounds like that you have made your peace with, you know, your past. And I applaud you for not, you know, being able to be blackmailed or influenced by people, you know, trying to do something so slimy and nasty. There is, you know, there are a lot of people working on my campaign. You're just hearing from me. I'm the spokesperson, but there are hundreds, thousands even, of people that have supported my campaign. We have all but three states now donations from. They're all grassroots donations. We have taken no money from corporate PACs or corporate lobbyists at all. And people are really excited to hear someone speak up for the policies that they know that the U.S. needs. And of course, it's only the senator from Maine, but the U.S. Senate is for the American people. And a lot of progressives have recognized that and said, we are behind you. You know, please go in there. And, you know, honestly, Ryan, I think that you would understand what I mean when I say it's going to have to be an inside-outside strategy. If I can serve on the inside, I am happy to do that. But it's not going to happen without a big outside strategy, too. But yeah, we're coming to the breaking point. So,
no, I couldn't agree with you more. We have to try to change the party from within and change the government from the inside. But we also have to organize and agitate and build movements outside of the two corporate parties to actually get to a point where we can free this nation from corporate rule and have a society where, you know, working class people can live a dignified life. You know, one of the things, there was a video this week that went viral, and it kind of started this whole debate about class, because, you know, that's kind of one of the, you know, you never hear MSNBC or CNN talking about class issues and talking about policies that will help the working class. You know, it's always, you know, oh, Pelosi ripped up this piece of paper. Oh, Trump said this. You know, it's always these kind of frivolous things to kind of distract us from the real issues that you alluded to earlier in the podcast. But there was this video, this woman was asked if she supports, you know, housing in her neighborhood, low-income housing, you know, for single moms and for families to get back on their feet that need help. And she said very blatant and clear, like, no, I don't support that. I don't want those people playing with my children. You know, we have a certain amount of money and I just don't want that around me. And it was just a moment of, like, of course the reaction was as it should be, you know, very pronounced, but it just got me thinking, like, you know, that where is the compassion, you know, in our society for our fellow Americans? You know, just because someone doesn't make as much money as you do, it doesn't mean that they don't get to live a dignified life as well, you know? And it's like, that to me is what the progressive movement is all about, fighting for policies like Medicare for all or housing for all, so that we can, Americans can live a dignified life. And it was just so weird to me to see, I mean, it just blew up, but do you think that we don't talk enough about the poor and about the working class in our politics?
Well, I, you know, the corporate media makes sure that we don't talk about that, and that we think of wealth as some kind of, like, a sign of virtue and poverty as some kind of sign that, you know, of a lack of virtue. We definitely need to talk about real people that are struggling. And there's no reason. I mean, again, it's an unusual thing about Maine. Maine is not a rich state. It never has been. Are there some affluent, wealthy people that live along the coast or, you know, live in the southern part of Maine? There are some, but for the most part, Maine has been economically depressed since I was born here. And so that kind of knowing your neighbors and knowing that they don't have a lot of money, if they have some kind of accident or illness, they're probably going to have to declare bankruptcy. But, you know, they work hard. They take care of their family. They'll help their a neighbor. Maine is the kind of place where if your car skids off the slippery road in winter and, you know, ends up in the snowbank, the first person that comes along will stop and help you. And they will not ask you, like, are you a Democrat or a Republican? Right. They will, you know what I mean? They'll just see a person in need and they'll help them. And sometimes people say about Maine when people move from other states where maybe people are a little more, have a more aggressive speaking style, they'll say, in Maine, we're nice. Now, I'm not saying that white, you know, politeness and civility hasn't papered over a lot of vicious racism in Maine and elsewhere, but I do think that the civil tone and being respectful of others, I can't tell you how many people have gotten back to me after the debates and said, I can't stand to see those two women tearing each other down. The other day, the other independent in the race swore a little bit. He said bullshit at one point. He said hell a couple of times. And the Democratic candidate said, well, I just wish that we would not have swearing because children are watching. And there was something about that remark that stuck in my craw, Ryan. And I thought about it for a couple of days and I realized, wait a minute. What children shouldn't be seeing is two grown women calling each other liars, making denigrating remarks about each other and holding that up as this is a debate for, you know, a high office in your state. This is political discourse.
Right. Children should be seeing people discussing policies that benefit their lives and their families' lives. You know, children should be seeing, people who have power want to use that power to help the less fortunate, not use that power to make themselves richer or make the corporations richer, which is just what our politics has unfortunately turned into. You know, there's no empathy, there's no compassion, there's no dignity. I feel like the disease in America is greed. There's just this greed and it's infected everything that we do. And no one has ever stopped to be like, wait, more isn't more. You know, we need balance. We need balance in this economy. We don't need to have the world's first trillionaire. We don't need two men to hold more wealth than half of our nation. You know, we need an economy that wealth gets distributed more evenly and where the working class gets rewarded. You know, the working class of this nation have been carrying this country on its back for the last half century. Meanwhile, the billionaires just keep getting richer and richer. And then they don't even end up paying their fair share in taxes. They hide all their money in the Cayman Islands.
I know.
So it's like at some point, like it's time for the billionaires to pay up. It's time for them to pay their fair share. It's time for these corporations to start treating their workers with dignity, you know, and it's time for our government to start treating the people with dignity and to stop, you know, the fear mongering and the tribalism and the partisanship that just divides us from one another. You know, as much as I disagree with Trump on everything, I now, as an activist who wants to unite the working class to take this country back for the people, I try to stay away from anything that would divide the working class from coming together. Because I believe that, you know, working class independents, Republicans, Democrats, leftists, if we can all come together, that is the greatest threat to the oligarchy. That is the greatest threat to the billionaire class, is to see finally the working class come together and take back our power.
Indeed. Unions are an example of people coming together in the common interest. They may not all have the same political beliefs, but they understand, well, withholding our labor is the biggest power that we have. So if you want our labor, you need to meet our terms. And I enjoyed being a union negotiator because I felt like, you know, I'm very clear on what the priorities are of all these constituents I'm representing. I know what they're willing to give up I know what they're not willing to give up. And I'm going to come to the table with my strongest ask. And if I can't get the contract they deserve, then fine. Let's start the school year without a contract then, see how that goes. And of course, management gets more and more and more nervous. And teachers aren't by law allowed to go on strike, at least in this state. But I think that the workers withholding their labor is a huge power that they are going to realize. And it's hard to organize such a big country and so many people, but it's the only thing that's going to save us, really.
And you just hit a very important point that made my heart tickle when you said that you started your negotiation from the strongest ask, from the strongest point, because what we've seen from the Democratic Party is even during a campaign, right? During a campaign, you're supposed to be bold. You're supposed to be aspirational. You're supposed to shoot for the moon, right? You're supposed to fight for the strongest ask from the, you know, before you get to the negotiating table with Republicans. But what we see corporate Democrats do is they're, before they're even negotiating with Republicans in Congress or, you know, the a Democratic president in the White House, they're already starting from a watered down moderate position. So by the time we meet with Republicans, we're already at the moderate position. Then the Republicans just take it more to the right. So that's why, like, for the last 50 years, we've seen, you know, while the Republicans never moderate their message to appeal to Democrats, Democrats do nothing but moderate their message so they will try to appeal to a few disaffected Republicans or so they won't offend Republicans. And what we've seen is just the country shift further and further to the right. And if we're going to heal this nation, we need to move left. We need to move left to justice, left to Medicare for all, left to a Green New Deal, you know, left to a living wage, left to housing for all. Not start these negotiations from a watered down point. I just couldn't agree with you more. Made me so happy.
Could not agree with you more. You don't go in already compromising. You go in knowing I have millions of people behind me that believe as I do, you know, so I'm going to put our terms on the table and it's up to you to figure out how to meet them because we've got the labor. I don't think people in this country really study labor history either, but if they did, they would quickly see. I have a lot of hope for unions like the Nurses Union. They are badass.
They know their power. And I think you hit a big point. I think that the American people have forgotten that we do have the power because these very powerful interests have beaten us down and beaten us down now for decades. And it's time for us to remind, you know, them that we are the ones who have power. We're the ones who decide if you get elected or not, you know, and you have to earn our vote. We're not just going to give it to you. I think that the people are starting to wake up to see the power they have. I mean, you don't just hand politicians, you know, your vote without demanding anything in return, you know, because then what these politicians just hand all their power to the billionaire class and to Wall Street. That is why we have to, you know, keep waking people up to see how much power they have and how they can change this country electorally and also, you know, doing the work, direct action and doing, you know, work outside of the electoral process. Yes.
The gotcha question people like to ask me is, oh, how about all those arrests? You know, if they did the opposition research on me, it's like, how many times have you been arrested? Well, I have been arrested at General Dynamics warship plant here at several times because I've tried everything else. I tried meeting with my congressional reps. I've written letters to the editor. I've, you know, tried everything and using direct action and using my white privilege to get arrested. And we won a big court case one time over, we were charged with criminal trespass. And the judge said, it was a libertarian judge, but he said, well, the only reason you didn't let these people into your public event is you didn't like the content of what their signs said. That's protected political speech under the First Amendment. You know, are you acquitted.
You got arrested trying to stop the wars.
Oh yeah,
sure. That makes you like the most badass candidate for Congress for the Senate this cycle. That is amazing. No, like that is the kind of boldness that we need. Someone who's put their body on the line. Someone who is willing to make that sacrifice for the greater good. You were willing to get arrested to stop the wars. I mean, I think that so many progressives I know feel like are giving up on electoral politics because they're like, what's the point? You know, we these people give us great speeches. They say they're going to change the system and then they go in and the system changes them, right? And so we need to know that like people like you have the courage to stand up to these corrupt influences and to these corporate influences and that even when you get into the fire, you know, because it's easy right now, you know, but people need to know that like, yeah, you were willing to put your body on the line to stop wars. Like, because that means you're willing to go in Congress and to give speeches that are uncomfortable, but that the people of this country need to hear.
I've been part of some real struggles. They were group struggles. They weren't necessarily about stopping the war, different things. And sometimes we won and sometimes we didn't. But I know what it looks like. It looks like lots and lots and lots of people bringing their skills, trusting each other, listening to each other, and working in a concerted effort, applying pressure at the vulnerable spot in the power structure. So that's what I'm interested in doing.
I love that. And I ask everyone who comes on the podcast who's running for office, what have you learned about America and what have you learned about yourself, Lisa, in running for the Senate?
Well, I have learned about America that people are much more hopeful and hungry for hope than they are portrayed in the mass media. They actually are underneath still idealistic. They still want a better world for their children and their grandchildren. So I've learned that people are not mostly cynical at all. They still believe. What I've learned about myself is that I can learn new technology platforms, like 3 or 4 new ones a day. It's not fun. That's, you know, I like talking with people and hearing from people. That's the fun part. But gosh, there've been a lot of technology challenges. I had to move from my home. I'm temporarily living with friends because in rural Maine where I live, there isn't enough broadband to even do a Zoom call. And so that has been those challenges. You know, I was about to retire from teaching. I'm not a super young person anymore, but I always love to learn. And I have a great team and I have great kids that help me. And, you know, my oldest son said to his siblings, you know, I wouldn't have done this if my family didn't say, oh, we are behind you 100%. Last summer when the kids were all visiting, having summer in Maine, my eldest said to his siblings, ask not what mom can do for you. Rather ask what you can do for mom's campaign. And it turned out to be true. They've all helped in various ways. And, you know, my sisters and just, it's been amazing to me how many people have come together. I feel like now I have a whole new, really big family, people all over the country that are pulling together, you know, to try to put the first green in the U.S. Senate and see what we can do with that foothold. So, I mean,
yesterday, the Rank Lisa First was trending on Twitter nationally
for
a moment. Yeah,
it
was.
I didn't know that. Oh,
yeah,
exciting.
Rank Lisa First, because they were, I think the Sarah Gideon campaign was tweeting out fire Susan. So a bunch of us tweeted, yes, we need to fire Susan, but we don't need to replace her with a corporate Democrat. We need to replace her with a true progressive who is fighting for Medicare for all and a Green New Deal. And thankfully, Maine has ranked choice voting. So let's fire Susan, but hashtag rank Lisa First. So
thank you, Ryan.
I saw a lot of people tweeting that, and I tweeted it too. And it was really cool to see you. And this conversation has just been so insightful and informative. And I love what you said about idealism, because as someone who believes in a better world, I get attacked all the time by centrists who are cynical and think that we have to compromise our values to beat Republicans. And I always tell them, no, we don't have to compromise our values to win. We have to fight for our values to win. And we have to fight for this world, for this better world that we want to bring to fruition. And we have to stop compromising when it comes to things like healthcare for everyone. And when it comes to things like saving our planet from the climate crisis. And when it comes to issues like racial injustice and income inequality, it is time for us to fight and to fight back against all of this greed that has corrupted our political system. So I'm so honored to get this time with you, Lisa, and thank you for being in this fight. And finally, how can my listeners get involved in your campaign as far as phone banking, and where can they go to donate to your campaign?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Ryan. It's been great. So our website is lisafor, spelled out F-O-R, Maine, M-A-I-N-E.org. And you can donate there. You can also go to the action button and sign up to volunteer. You know, tell us what your strengths are and what you'd like to work on, and we can bring you in. Our team is growing by leaps and bounds right now. It's really exciting, a lot of energy. So love to have anybody that believes as we do that the world can be a better place if we all work together on it.
That's amazing. Well, thank you so much, and we'll be in touch, okay?
Okay, great. Thank you, Ryan.
Bye, Lisa.
Be well. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Lisa Savage. And before I go, I want to take a moment to thank all of our Patreon subscribers. If you want to support the podcast and my grassroots advocacy work, you can go to patreon.com/proudsocialist. I really appreciate all the support. And this week, I want to thank David, James Quinn, Juliana Seymour, Susan McGraw-Kieber, Kathleen Alexander, Lisa, Susan Sarandon,
Kenny Alums, Eli Harris Mavis, Troy Hewitt, Sean O'Brien, Mason, Charlie Wilkin, Sean Stubblefield, Stanley Korinsky, William McLaughlin, DJ Comatose, Frank Cardenas, Joyce Yang, Jeremy Leeming, Liz Kirkland, Jeff Bonner, William Holtz, Trent Tobler, Michael Hardy, Molly Secors, Insurgent, Alexandra Orso, Shayna Pearson, Patty Cleary, Walter Hackett, Alan Wood, Russell Whitworth, Ruben Sanchez Jr., Elizabeth Kim, John Lloyd IV, and Eileen O'Farrell. Thank you so much for supporting the podcast, and I hope everyone has a great weekend, and I'll catch you next week with an all-new episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight.